I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education. It's my pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tonight is the last Tuesday evening lecture for the spring 2014 season, and we are closing with artist Matthew Buckingham. Matthew Buckingham's work has intrigued me for some time, and I am so very happy and appreciative that he accepted the invitation to be here tonight. There is a quality and thoughtfulness to the work and an intellectual rigor to his practice that I would envy if I did not find it its existence so satisfying. There is a slowness and aptness about this work that makes me glad it is in the world. And I'm very appreciative that Matthew accepted my invitation, because I have to say I've been extending it over the years since I first encountered his work in 2004. But he's a busy man, and I would prefer that he make the art that he makes than to take time to come here and do a lecture. So I'm glad he only accepted when the time was right. Matthew is an artist who seems to employ any means necessary, utilizing photography, film, and video, making unique objects and installations, writing and drawing, all to explore social memory and historical representation. He has published several artist books, including Everything I Need, False Future, and The Spirit of the Letter, all at Camden Art Center in London, as well as a captivating little artist book titled Improbable Horse, published with the Des Moines Art Center in 2008, of which a few copies remain in the Modern's bookstore. So I encourage you to get over. I think there might be four left. Now living and working in New York and teaching at Columbia University, Matthew attended the School of Art Institute of Chicago before receiving his BFA from the University of Iowa. He also has an MFA from Bard College and participated in the Whitney Independent Study Program. Represented by Murray Guy Gallery in New York, Matthew's work is in prominent public collections, including the Metropolitan, SF MoMA, and the Museum of Modern Art in New York. He has had solo exhibitions in recent years at Conrad Fischer Gallery in Dusseldorf, the Brooklyn Museum, the Reina Sofia in Madrid, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver, the Art Institute, and the Art Institute of Chicago. His work was chosen for the Liverpool Biennial International in 2006 and the 48th Corcoran Biennale. Matthew was a 2007 Art Pace resident and the 2003 recipient of the DAAD Artist in Berlin Fellowship. In BOM magazine, Matthew's work is said to reframe the question of experience itself in the Walter Benjamin sense. Experience as a result of totality of a person's perception, interpretation, and memory. Such is not casually accomplished. Tonight we have the great fortune of Matthew being here to offer insight into his work and his practice. Please join me in giving him a warm welcome.
Thank you so much, Terry, for that introduction. That was really wonderful. And it is great to be here at the Modern, finally. And I'm enjoying it very much. And I also want to extend thanks to Michael Moore for assisting with everything and making everything run so smoothly, and John Knuckles for the same with regard to the talk tonight. I really value this type of face-to-face encounter and conversation basically as a chance for me to learn something. And I'm going to try to cover a lot of ground and also save time for a discussion at the end. So I want to begin with reading a short passage from Chapter 3 of Herman Melville's Moby Dick, where Ishmael, the narrator of the story, has just arrived at the Spouter Inn in Nantucket before embarking on the novel's journey. Entering that gabled Spouter Inn, you found yourself in a wide, low, straggling entry with old-fashioned wainscots reminding one of the bulwarks of some condemned old craft. On one side hung a very large oil painting, so thoroughly besmoked and every way defaced, that in the unequal crosslights by which you viewed it, it was only by diligent study and a series of systematic visits to it and careful inquiry of the neighbors that you could anyway arrive at an understanding of its purpose. Such unaccountable masses of shades and shadows that at first you almost thought some ambitious young artist in the time of the New England hags had endeavored to delineate chaos bewitched. But by dint of much and earnest contemplation and oft repeated ponderings, and especially by throwing open the little window towards the back of the entry, you at last come to the conclusion that such an idea, however wild, might not be altogether unwarranted. But what most puzzled and confounded you was a long, limber, portentous, black mass of something hovering in the center of the picture over three blue, dim, perpendicular lines floating in a nameless yeast. A boggy, soggy, squitchy picture, truly. Enough to drive a nervous man distracted. Yet, was there a sort of indefinite, half-attained, unimaginable sublimity about it that fairly froze you to it, till you involuntarily took an oath with yourself to find out what that marvelous painting meant? Ever and anon, a bright, but alas, deceptive idea would dart through you. It's the Black Sea in a midnight gale. It's the unnatural combat of the four elements. It's a blasted heath. It's a Hyperborean winter scene. It's the breaking up of the ice-bound stream of time. But at last, all these fancies yielded to that one pretentious something in the picture's midst. That, once found out, and all the rest were plain. But stop, does it not bear a faint resemblance to a gigantic fish? Even the great Leviathan itself? In fact, the artist's design seemed this: a final theory of my own, partly based upon the aggregated opinions of many aged persons with whom I conversed upon the subject. The picture represents a Cape Horner in a great hurricane, the half-foundered ship weltering there with its three dismantled masts, alone visible, and an exasperated whale purposing to spring clean over the craft is in the enormous act of impaling himself upon the three mastheads. So what I want to talk about tonight is actually contained in that passage. Our beliefs, or my beliefs, and the conditions that I think shape the meaning of art. I'm taking the opportunity of this talk this evening to try to think through some of my basic assumptions, as Øyvind Fahlstrøm said. And maybe we can dim the lights and I'll start with some of the images. I believe that art is mimetic, ambiguous, and that we mainly use it to test reality. This notion of mimesis is quite obvious. It's so familiar we often skip over it when we start to look at something, or even when we're reading and we don't consider of imitation that we're encountering and interpreting. The English language, of course, has lots of words that are related to mimesis: mimicry, imitation, resemblance, semblance, similitude, verisimilitude, realism, simulation, and so on, down to even borrowed words such as trompe l'oeil. When we think of imitation, I think we often assume that we are that there that there's a that something must have been that is being imitated, something that is being imitated, or something that could be or should be is being imitated, a kind of proposition. Here we have an image of Catharina van Hemessen, painted in 1548. The Latinized inscription that you see hovering sort of ambiguously midair there between her and her canvas could be translated into English as, "I, Catharina van Hemessen, painted myself in 1548. And then it switches case and says, "She was 20 years old." This is the earliest known self-portrait by a woman artist depicting herself at work in a studio painting. And of course, she's actually painting her self-portrait, presumably the one that we are looking at. So there's a deep set of ambiguities that unravel here within the imitation, within the illusion. The looking at an image like this, and I think in every case engaging with artwork, these unconscious desires or drives are at work that include certain versions of a pleasure drive or a knowledge drive, the pleasure that we take in looking at things and assimilating information through our senses. And of course, there's this compulsion to be mimetic, to imitate, that comes even through behavior and through the learning process. The highest functions that we have are mimetic, ending with language, where metaphor itself is a kind of mimesis within language, one word standing in for another. Imitating reality, of course, also raises the question of value. It challenges art to justify itself. What is the value of an illusion, of a lie? When illusions fail, they become ambiguous. I suppose we can find an example or a few examples of that even in the Catharina portrait, self-portrait. Ambiguity interrupts illusions and creates a kind of binary of sorts of the thing, not the thing, the illusion, the similarity, the dissimilarities. And if transparency is at one end of our imaginary spectrum of imitation, the other end would be something like opacity or the refusal of the illusion, or maybe not the illusion, but a kind of total ambiguity. The fundamental unknowability of the other, so to say. And I think we could even relate that sort of refusal to transparency to the refusal of colonization or these kind of objectified forms of oppression that claim a kind of transparency through language, through understood meaning, assuming a position of authority through being understood, so to say. This relationship between imitation or mimesis and illusion and its opposition or disruption by ambiguity, or more aggressively through opacity, also leads to a kind of triangulation in the mind with play. And there are several forms of that triangulation, I would say. But one, the most obvious so far, is this one of going back and forth or playing with the ambiguity and the multiple meanings. Of course, the word ambiguity or ambiguous is also ambiguous. It has two meanings. It can mean, on the one hand, uncertainty, or on the other hand, a word or an image or an object that has multiple legitimate meanings. And of course, a word or an object like that produces the first meaning. It produces uncertainty. This sense of play, I think, can also have another endpoint in critique or judgment. And this is where the notion of reality testing comes in. If we think of it as a triangulated situation, the we as makers of art and viewers of art are constantly moving between these positions through this sense of play. Artists tend to do this with physical arrangement, and viewers tend to do it in an imaginary tactile sense, at least in the conventions that we have for visual art, which we don't touch, but we move mentally or we think about changing, in a sense, through the way that we read it. Probably the simplest form of mimesis is also a form of play, the notion of imitating something with the body. If we think about dance as mimesis, then we're wrestling with a certain level of abstraction and ambiguity, but at the same time, we seem to know somehow what those metaphors are, the metaphors of movement, and how they relate to the real world. So play exists in the imagination and in the real outside world. It is a kind of bridge between self and other. It's a neutral area where experience is unchallenged, I would say. This is really the journey from subjectivity to objectivity. If we think of the individual person as a unit with a limiting membrane, an outside and an inside, then the third part of life that we, I think, so often ignore is that intermediate area of experiencing, where we are actually bridging self and other, the other self and other self, through our experiences. And again, this, I think, we could look at it as a kind of reality testing, a sort of comparison of inner realities. And it's interesting to consider what happens when an unmanageable demand is made upon us by someone else's inner reality. We tend to reject that, or we don't compare it favorably. An extreme categorization would be madness, perhaps, something that is unacceptable or inappropriate behavior. I think that when we also look at the production of art, the circumstances, the conditions for the production of art, we also find a related triangulation. This is something that early on interested me as a person studying or thinking about art in the student role, I guess. The question of how time functions in different media and how there is perhaps a continuum across different media if we look at the temporal aspects involved in not only their production but the implied temporalities within the works. And for photography, film, and video, these relations of time, we take them as being somehow endemic or built in to them. We used to call that or relate that to their indexical quality. Photography and film, on the one hand, in their analog forms, always insist on something that was. Or if we look to Roland Barthes, in terms of language and tense, we could paraphrase what he says as the tense of film and photography is this will have been, a kind of complex future past tense. I think that this ambiguity always provokes speculation and interpretation, the kind of interpretation that I've been implying in what I've been saying about mimesis and ambiguity. And it always concerns at least three points. There are always the basic three positions within that set of speculations. Oh, and I should say, this, by the way, is a photograph of Babette Mangold, taken by Babette Mangold, of one of Trisha Brown's performances. I believe it's called Roof Piece, it's from 1973. It was a dance that took place on different rooftops simultaneously. There is also a film which was made or shot by Babette Mangold also. But again, a kind of oscillation, three points, where the viewer is in a relationship with the artist and the subject, but perhaps spread out over different temporalities. Each position perhaps being in a different temporality, but not always. That's the interesting thing about video, that when it appeared and, well, when it first appeared, there was no choice but to look at it as a purely live medium with no way of recording it. And I think that it carried that idiom, so to say, with it over time, always carrying the possibility of being simultaneous, of happening at the moment that you're watching it or happening it elsewhere as you're watching it. So this question of what am I looking at, the kind of correlation between production and reception of images, events and narration. And it really boils down for me to the very terse sort of soundbite of Jean-Paul Sartre that an image is nothing else than a relationship. And this is what brings this question into the social realm. This is what makes, for me, the economy of images that we live in very social, even in their static form or the form that we trade in static images. So I've sort of run roughshod over some of my basic beliefs, I would say, and these are the broadest bases that I would say I use for making and looking at art. And I use these conceptions of culture and production as frameworks for trying to raise equally broad questions about other subjects, objects and things that I seek out or that present themselves to me. I was born to a family of farmers and educators in Iowa who taught me that we live in a nation state founded on settler colonialism and slavery, which has been cast as a democratic republic. And as a child, I became curious about what it meant to be an artist. I studied drawing and video at the School of the Art Institute, as Terry mentioned, and film production and film history and theory at the University of Iowa. And then I moved to New York City in 1988, and I supported myself working for a wide variety of artists and filmmakers. And I remember that year talking with artist friends my age, and we all wondered if we or our artworks were postmodern. And at the time, I thought literary studies and film studies had made a convincing case that all narration is constructed, that it's a way of plotting and explaining events, real or imagined. And, of course, at the time, empiricists were pushing back against this with charges of relativism, making a counterclaim that was less convincing to me, that it was possible to write about the past in a scientific manner. But surrounded at that moment by the AIDS crisis and the so-called culture wars, it seemed to me that some stories about the past were much more adequate than others. But beyond intuition, what was my judgment based on? A few years later, the anthology that Joan Scott and Judith Butler edited, Feminists Theorize the Political, was published, and I read Joan Scott's essay titled Experience. For Joan Scott, experience becomes not the origin of our explanations, not the authoritative because seen or felt evidence that grounds what is known, but rather something that we seek to explain or that we have to explain. And something that about which knowledge is produced. This was a big shift for me. To think about experience in this way is to historicize it as well as to historicize the identities that it produces, rather than seeing the identities as evidence, seeing the identities as produced by experience. As Stuart Hall said, identities are formed at the unstable point where personal lives meet the narrative of history. Identity is an ever unfinished conversation. Experience is the process by which, for all social beings, subjectivity is constructed. On the other hand, history is often a discipline that has typically constructed itself in opposition to ideas about literature. History subscribes to a referential conception of language, the belief in a direct relationship between words and things. Experience is called upon as evidence. Experience is at once always already an interpretation and is in need of interpretation. What counts as experience is neither self-evident nor straightforward. It's always contested, always therefore political, therefore never a direct relationship that is so often assumed even in the framework that is appropriated through history writing. I started to believe that after, I'm just mentioning the one essay, but of course there were many other things that I was thinking about, but at that point in my thought, I started to believe that this contest of meaning that I'm describing is what produces more or less adequate narratives. And then quickly, to move on to my own work, just to touch on who I've been talking about, basically. Aristotle, in this discussion of mimesis and play and ambiguity, a lot of these ideas, of course, come from Aristotle, Walter Benjamin, Susan Sontag, who has a really interesting place in the whole discussion around mimesis and the interpretation of art, if you remember her. Sort of now shocking to read essay against interpretation. William Empson, Seven Types of Ambiguity. He had a very ambiguous form of beard. Truly a unique person. Edward Glissant, from whom I've been reading and thinking a lot about this concept of opacity, deliberate forms of ambiguity. And D.W. Winnicott, the psychoanalyst who is credited with the notion of transitional object in child development, which he extends to the notion of culture at large, that the teddy bear is a kind of cultural object that's analogous to almost all forms of culture that we experience, with which we do this kind of reality testing that I've been mentioning. And Joan Scott at Princeton University. This is a photograph I took, what year is it? 2008, when I happened to be in Berlin, on the day that the name of a street was changed from Kochstrasse to Rudi Dutschke Strasse, which is at the fortuitous or ominous intersection of Axel Springer Strasse, which in a way, through language and geography and the incredibly complex history of the built environment in Berlin, puts a kind of small capstone on a very long conflict that began in the, well, right after World War II, basically. Rudi Dutschke was a student activist in the German New Left who found great opposition from Axel Springer, one of the big publishers, kind of reactionary conservative media mogul in Germany and Berlin. And Dutschke was a fairly controversial figure, although nothing like the Biedermeierhof. He was involved in that movement, but not in the Biedermeierhof. So it was actually quite a big deal when this section of street was renamed for him. But I'm just showing this, I guess, as subjectless or personless example of this kind of work that I'm talking about, or these relationships, the idea of an image as a relationship. I've tried to select a number of things from in different media. This was a postcard project, actually. It was a project circulated as a postcard, 4x6 inch postcard, called Canal Street Canal, where I set myself the goal or the problem of what could represent, or what could we feel a nostalgia for that never existed. And I worked with this 18th century proposal to make a shipping canal out of Canal Street. Canal Street in New York City is built over top of a small natural stream that was turned into a kind of sewage canal for a number of years and then paved over. It actually still flows under Canal Street. And there was this 18th century proposal to widen it enormously and connect the Hudson River and the East River. And the project was a very oblique, or it was not a response in any way, but it was obliquely influenced by the events of September 11th, 2001, where I circulated this postcard in the tourist postcard racks on Canal Street. And of course, at the time, all the other postcards were about the events. It was this was just a few months after September 11th. It was in the spring. And this sort of the piece was actually shown. It was shown along Canal Street, but this shop is actually the same shop that's in, there's the yellow stairs. So the postcard was actually in itself, so to say. This is just a close-up of a very rudimentary scissors. This is sort of, it's not pre-Photoshop, but I regressed pre-Photoshop. It's a very tactile kind of collage where I took a photograph of the Hudson River and I took a photograph of Canal Street and put them together. Again, circulating an object in a totally different way. This is called Maybe Opened After 10th of August, 3011. It's a time capsule, basically. A bronze box containing undisclosed contents, where in this case I was pursuing, I guess, a kind of meta art object that would raise questions of its lifespan and its care and what would happen to it over time as it traveled or didn't this 1,000 years. The time capsule to me is an interesting concept because it's so American. Almost the invention of the necessity for history or archiving. But at the same time, it's very quotidian and often, frankly, disappointing. Maybe not to me, but in its reception. You know, the objects that are often included in a time capsule are quite ordinary, or they're thought to be something that may not exist in the future, and then, of course, most often it turns out it is something we still have. So I wanted to think about that, and also this secrecy, you know, the lack of knowing what's inside something that you're taking care of, and why are you taking care of it, and what does it mean? This is an installation, a very simple photo text installation piece. The six grandfathers Pahasapa in the year 502-1002 CE. A black and white photograph. And a close-up of this area of the photograph, which starts to look a bit familiar. It's my attempt, with the help of a stone erosion expert via email and telephone at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, to try to imagine the future of Mount Rushmore after it's lost its representational powers, after it no longer carries its image and is no longer a mark of colonial power over a landscape. I deliberately chose an early National Park Service photograph. So it's actually doesn't really look like this now, and it certainly wouldn't in 500,000 years. But I sort of wanted to join the beginning to the end, so to say. Now in the pile of rubble there, you have trouble seeing that pile of rubble these days. It's full of trees, and if you've read that interesting book, The World Without Us, you know how quickly things change, and this would look nothing like this, actually. But at the same time, it's a projection, a space of projection or imagination, hopefully, which is accompanied by a timeline, a very subjectively written timeline of events around the Pahasapa and what became Mount Rushmore, beginning in the Cretaceous period, prehistoric geological time, and projecting 500,000 years into the future. The viewer enters this space. Normally the traffic pattern brings the viewer to the photograph first, and then the viewer makes a decision. Are they going to read the timeline backward or jump to the beginning and read it forward to the photograph? The motivation for this project came from a chance encounter that I had with reading a Supreme Court decision, actually, which was fairly recent, I forget the exact date now, where the Lakota people actually won the Supreme Court case that the Pahasapa and Mount Rushmore, that this land does legally belong to them due to the treaties that were signed in the mid-19th century. But the Supreme Court also put into the decision the language that, quote-unquote, due to the passage of time, the material return of the land is not possible. And I thought that was an incredible turn of language upon which to base this type of decision. Due to the passage of time, that these 150 years somehow outweigh the 10,000, well, the couple of hundred years that the Lakota lived in that area, and the 10 to 20, 25,000 years of human occupation of the area. This is a video installation project. I'll just show you some images from it and talk about how the project came about. A lot of times, I guess, I feel that projects, I guess I'm very interested in locating myself in as many ways as I possibly can. And over the years, as the discourse and even in the popular press, this notion of post-feminism started to get traction, I started keeping notes about it, I guess, and it just, to me, was a very curious way of undermining something and talking about something. And I was also spending a lot of time in Denmark at the time, teaching and working on a project. And in Denmark, there was a very open declaration that feminism was no longer necessary because everything had been corrected, and we, the Danish people, are beyond that now. And spending time there, that I could tell that was not true. And it reminded me of the situation here. And in a kind of gut reaction, I just started thinking about Mary Wollstonecraft, the sort of proto-feminist, the anachronistically named founder of feminism, a movement she knew nothing about, a word she'd never heard, but at the same time, truly a forebear of the notion, and a fascinating, radical political philosopher of the 18th century. And I started thinking about the wish or the fantasy of someone like her or her coming back as a ghost, basically, reporting on her time in our time, and looking at the contrast, the connections, and the use of language. And I started thinking what would be a good space for her to manifest. And looking around, I looked at, not physically, but just by remote internet and other means of research, I started looking at 18th century spaces that did exist in her time that still exist. And this one called out loudly to me, the Boys' Lounge at the Westminster School, which, you know, is an elite educational institution, which is, I think, 600 years old. Many prime ministers of England have been educated there. And it also started admitting female students in 1968, I believe, about 500 years into its history. And I thought that would be a good place for Mary to show up. And I had this notion, a friend of mine had actually told me about her experience with a ghost that she claimed to have had, where the ghost that was troubling her apartment was sitting on the ceiling. And I thought that was a perfect place for Mary Wollstonecraft, who both did and didn't want to turn the world upside down, and would, you know, be granted a gravity-free life as a ghost. And so that's what we did. I had the chance to work with an actor, Kate Miles, and had a production team in London who built this room for us upside down. And it was a completely analog project, a video project that used one of the first trick film techniques to create this illusion. And there we are on the ceiling rehearsing. And I wrote a text that was comprised of only things that Mary Wollstonecraft had written and only things that she knew in her lifetime had been published. I did not want to get into personal letters or biography. I wanted to keep everything in the public realm. But what's interesting about her, she's in that romantic tradition that is also political, that is a radical politics of resistance through romanticism, not the other conception of romanticism, which as an escape or escapism, but actually one which is disrupting the time. And so it became a kind of period piece, a monologue that takes place in this room. And then there are a few moments where she does appear right side up, so to say. And those were the only digital effects, were when she's in the correct position. And here's a sort of difficult to read sketch about the space of the installation, where I wanted to put the viewer in a mirrored position of Mary Wollstonecraft, to see oneself in the position that you see Mary in the video. So I constructed, just using a few elements, just basically the video projection, the chandelier, which is in the film, the video, and an inverted mirror to spatialize this whole project, so that when you are standing by the mirror, by the chandelier, you're in the same position that she's in. And she's about life size when she's standing next to the chandelier in the video image. And then the whole thing is sort of compressed or condensed at the back of the space in this mirror, where the two rooms come together, one inverted, the other right side up. And when I was in London and I was finishing the research and starting the production, this is Mary Wollstonecraft and William Godwin's grave site at St. Pancras burial ground, I was further convinced that there was still a reason for Mary Wollstonecraft to revisit us. I was totally shocked by the way that she's referred to here in this guide to the Hull Cemetery. Also thinking about the opposite, making things go away. This is a project called Image of Absalon to be projected until it vanishes. A slide, continuous slide projection of a single slide image with a small frame text that relates the history of the making of this monument, of the sort of mythic founder of Copenhagen, whose crusader name was Absalon. He was one of those warrior bishops of the Crusades, who built up an enormous amount of wealth in the Crusades, and then basically founded the city of Copenhagen. And it was a political battle, actually, between two groups of people who wanted to commemorate Absalon at the same time. And it became a kind of bureaucratic situation in Copenhagen in the late 19th century. And so this text accompanies the slow fade of the image, which starts out like this, and then over a number of weeks of the exhibition, Absalon does begin to fade. And it, to me, it was a kind of way of working with a different time frame, almost a cinematic fade in a non-cinema space, in a real space, where if you checked in every now and then or had a chance to pass by, you would notice this, and if not, it would be something in the imagination. So I'm going to end now with a 10-minute film, and then we'll open it up to questions. This is a film installation, 16mm film. We'll watch it on a video preview copy today. It is normally projected in a very sort of sketchy, relaxed atmosphere, so to say, that we'll talk about after the film. Just very casually, a sheet hung up, basically a cloth stretched across the space. Chairs from the time period that's referred to in the film. This is the way you would encounter this piece. And actually, if you happen to be traveling to Western Massachusetts or going to Mass Mocha, you could see this piece installed there right now in a very interesting exhibition called The Dying of the Light, artists working with film. I think there are 6 artists in this very interesting exhibition, each of us working in a different way with different questions about the life, so to say, of the film medium, of the analog film medium. So this is the setup, and now maybe we can take a look at the film. Maybe we can bring the lights all the way out and have a look. The film is about 11 minutes long.
Chez les animaux chasseurs et mangeurs d'autres animaux, les yeux sont d'habitude situés sur la face de la tête, à l'affût vers l'avant. Chez les animaux chassés, les yeux apparaissent souvent sur le côté de la tête, aux aguets dans plusieurs directions. Dans les deux cas, chasseur ou chassé, la fonction première de l'œil est de saisir le mouvement. On associe l'arrivée du cinéma à l'arrivée d'un train en gare de La Ciotat, dans le midi de la France, en 1895. Pourtant, 5 années avant que les frères Lumière ne filment cette scène, le secret d'une technologie cinématographique différente s'est évanoui à bord d'un autre train, le Dijon-Paris du 16 septembre 1890. Observons une séquence de plans fixes, à raison de moins de 16 par seconde. Notre œil comprend bien qu'en réalité, rien ne bouge. Mais à 16 images par seconde ou plus, nos détecteurs se laissent duper par une illusion de mouvement. L'illusion retient notre attention et nourrit notre désir d'autant mieux qu'on voit bien qu'il s'agit d'une illusion, pas de la réalité. Louis le Prince gérait une affaire de production de panorama à New York. Il y faisait bâtir et peindre des tableaux panoramiques représentant à une échelle épique les grands événements de l'époque. L'illusion du panorama tient à sa capacité à rendre crédible une image fixe, une action figée naturellement. Louis le Prince met au point une caméra capable d'exposer 16 images par seconde. Il travaillait de nuit, à son propre compte, dans un atelier d'une école pour sourds-muets à Manhattan, où sa femme enseignait les beaux-arts. Un soir, sa fillette s'aventura dans l'atelier. Le prince lui referma la porte au nez, sans égard. Elle se souviendrait plus tard qu'elle y aperçut une vive lumière projetée sur une grande toile blanche suspendue dans la pièce. Le prince savait que quelqu'un mettrait bientôt au point une manière de reproduire le mouvement en image. Il ne discutait jamais de ses expériences. Il travaillait directement avec chaque fournisseur afin que nul ne comprenne la nature de ses travaux. Les animaux aux yeux situés sur la face de la tête, des yeux qui regardent dans une même direction, ont certes des champs de vision étroits, mais ils apprennent à distinguer la profondeur, la troisième dimension. L'une des caméras de Le Prince était dotée de 16 objectifs, 8 paires en colonne verticale. était simplement pour pouvoir exposer 16 images en une seule seconde? Ou cherchait-il à créer un cinéma stéréoscopique? Ou même un panorama d'images tridimensionnelles en mouvement? Une synchronisation de dizaines de projections stéréoscopiques simultanées? L'emplacement des yeux de l'animal peut révéler s'il s'agit d'un prédateur ou d'une proie. Mais il y a toujours des exceptions. Ainsi, l'aliment de le requin. Un an après la caméra à 16 objectifs, le prince en fabriqua une à objectif unique. Cette dernière lui permit de produire au moins 3 films de 8 secondes chacun. À court de fonds, il rendit visite à son frère en France pour régler un héritage. Puis il monta à bord du train express Dijon-Paris et ne fut plus jamais revu. Sa caméra à objectif unique sera retrouvée chez lui, soigneusement rangée dans une mallette neuve. Si le prince avait survécu, le cinéma serait peut-être né 5 ans plus tôt. Au cours de ces 5 années, quels films auraient été réalisés? Lesquels auraient été sauvegardés? Nous serait-il aujourd'hui possible d'assister au procès du capitaine Dreyfus ou au coup d'État des États-Unis à Hawaï, aux funérailles d'Elephant Man, au massacre des Sioux à Wounded Knee, ou encore aux 23 cm de neige tombés sur la ville de la Nouvelle-Orléans en février 1895. Mais peut-être n'est-ce pas ainsi qu'il faut concevoir ce qui aurait pu être. La femme de Le Prince chercha des années durant à résoudre l'énigme de sa disparition. Elle avait l'idée qu'il avait été tué ou enlevé. Elle soupçonnait Thomas Edison. Le fils de Louis Le Prince se mit lui aussi à sa recherche, jusqu'à sa propre mort dans un mystérieux accident de fusil. Quelque temps avant sa visite à son frère, Le prince avait réalisé un film à Leeds, en Angleterre. Une vue plongeante sur le pont de la ville. Ce film comportait à l'origine 129 images. 20 subsistent aujourd'hui, soit un peu plus d'une seconde de film, enregistré sur le pont de Leeds, un jour d'avant septembre 1890. Ces 20 plans nous montrent 6 véhicules à chevaux, circulant dans des directions opposées. L'un des chariots est chargé d'énormes colis. Un autre transporte des passagers. De l'autre côté de la rue, 15 piétons se croisent le long du trottoir. L'un d'entre eux disparaît à un coin. 2 hommes traversent la rue en diagonale. L'un s'éloigne de la caméra. L'autre émerge au soleil de l'ombre d'un bâtiment, marchant vers la caméra. Une femme, empressée, double un homme qui promène tranquillement un jeune enfant par la main. Derrière ces derniers, une autre femme se rapproche. L'homme la reconnaît, la salue du chapeau. L'enfant ne la remarque pas. Une autre femme apparaît dans le bas du cadre. N'est-ce peut-être qu'une ombre? 2 hommes marchent vers la caméra, l'un très rapidement. L'autre s'essuie la nuque, ou peut-être le nez, avec un mouchoir ou sa manche de manteau. 2 hommes s'appuient sur la balustrade du pont, contemplant l'eau de la rivière dessous. L'un d'entre eux a une pipe en bouche. Un nuage de fumée s'élève et se dissipe au-dessus de sa tête. Plus loin, 3 hommes marchent d'un pas décidé. Et au-delà, tout près du bord de l'image, un homme pivote sur un pied, décrit un cercle, l'air incertain.
So, that's just to pull up the slide. So, that's that project. And yeah, I would like to open it up to questions and comments, and if there are any at this point. This is actually I should back up a second. This is the film. This is how it was preserved. The 20 frames that I mentioned in the text of the film. And then as a kind of GIF, this is the original film. Being repeated over and over. The film was made, it was shot from that yellow building, from the window of Le Prince's lawyer's office, actually, looking down on Leeds Bridge in Leeds, England. Yeah.
Have you looked at your film and thought about somebody or yourself talking about your film the way have you played it out?
I guess I think that's kind of implied in the project a little bit. That's what interested me about it from the beginning. I'm always interested in the way that photography and by extension film and video always have much more information captured than is used or could be used or even comprehended. The way that every photograph and film is also a document of its making. And I think that indeterminacy is part of the project. Yeah, to think about what, like time capsules, we can't make those things happen. You know what I mean? I can't ensure that anyone will see it after the Mass Mocha show. but I think that contingency, that's really part of that balance of ambiguity that interests me in the medium itself. So,
and the reason to make art versus to make film.
You mean to work with film in a different
right.
mode?
Kind
yeah.
of film about film as opposed
right.
to make a film.
Yeah. Well, you sort of said it in your introduction, because specifically I'm interested in the way that we encounter things. So I don't try to... I would never try to take total control over the way something is shown, but at the same time I try to take responsibility for that encounter with the viewer. And to... I guess on a very humble level or a different level, I am interested in creating a sort of experience that also needs to be explained. You know, the way that I was talking about paraphrasing Joan Scott as inverting, you know, saying that our experience isn't necessarily evidence of something. It's actually something that is begging to be contextualized and explained on a broader level because we are in a society and we're not atomized individuals. And that the metaphor of the cinema, which is quite powerful and also very interesting, is one of placelessness. And this architecture that we're in right now is ultimately meant to allow you to forget where you are and to project yourself into something else. Even if the lights are on and there were musicians here, this binary, you know, I think is still meant in that way. And that's what interests me or keeps me working in the art context, is that this is all up for grabs. And I even felt a little conflicted sort of staging the cinema to show this piece, but I really wanted also that sort of thin transference of looking at something that is set up the way that it was made, you know, where, you know, many years later, like 15 or 20 years after Le Prince disappeared, someone interviewed his daughter, and really her only memory of the whole project that was so secretive was this moment where she walked in, and then I thought that would be an interesting way of staging it, even though when you first walk in it just looks like normal. And that was really the impetus for the whole project, was to question the motivation. Why were so many people trying to invent moving images, something that they had never seen, that they didn't know? What was the drive behind that? And what did people imagine that it would be? And so then also to see that, you know, probably the first successful arrangement is the one that we're still in now, you know, that we still have this screen with us, and now we have it in our pocket, and, you know, it's ever integrated into our lives. So, yes?
I caught this one phrase in the Canal Street Canal postcard, in the text of it. There was a quote of Luc Sant about nostalgia,
right.
Talking about nostalgia being sort of a contempt for the present and a fear of the future. And I was thinking about that quote in relationship to your own use of history as a kind of consistent trope. And my seeing that, and even in the work, it doesn't seem that you're embracing nostalgia right. as the reason for that. I'm curious about how you think about your use of history in a different way.
Yeah, I think, you know, especially when I made that project, I was really looking at ways of resisting political forms of nostalgia that I felt were retrograde or destructive, but then also I suppose allowing for the even unconscious more aesthetic nostalgia that we carry around, that I think everyone has anyway, you know, that kind of like what I was saying about the Romantics, that appealing to emotion or dealing with emotion is also a way of navigating these kinds of narratives. So I, you know, I guess that's why I set that objective of, or the question of, you know, what would it mean to be nostalgic for something that never was? You know, is that actually pretty much like straight up nostalgia? You know, and let those things kind of touch each other. And so I think, you know, to go back to Walter Benjamin, I think there is a really interesting other way of looking at our relationship to the past, which is much more connected, let's say, where, you know, implicitly, I think, in some of his work, you know, I think it's really tricky going to Benjamin as an example of many things, because he was very complex and very contradictory, you know, over time, and you get many possible viewpoints when you read through him. But one thing that I think does sort of come out and hold up over the reading is this notion of questioning our metaphors about the past and about history. And, you know, if we just, there's so many spatial metaphors, let's say, for temporality, you know, but maybe two dominant ones are notions of the past and future in relation to horizons. You know, let's say we are in a point of view between two horizons. And, you know, the Greek model is sort of the opposite of what we, you know, I think now we probably more popularly think of the future somewhere in front of us, but the Greek notion was that we're looking at it and we're going this way and we don't know what's behind us. So this is the future. They're both interesting, but I think the thing about Benjamin is that, you know, for him, the vanishing point, you know, these are perspectival metaphors. The vanishing point of the past or of history is always right now, and that we actually occupy the space at which our past and the knowable past is disappearing, if we think it's disappearing. You know, maybe we don't. But either way, it's more connected. And you know, the reality that we live in our grandparents' future, this sort of connectedness of trying to hold through material trace, hold the past accountable for the present, so that everything really begins in the present. And, you know, to go back to those arguments in the 80s, the 1980s, and, you know, Joan Scott later, it does beg the question of relativism. You know, if every story about the past is really about the present, then is that relativistic? But I guess I've always been attracted to the notion of digging deeper than that and saying, you know, that there is a contest of meaning around that of, you know, no narration of past events can contain a one-to-one representation. So we're always dealing with language, which doesn't mean we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to say. Any other questions or comments or thoughts? Yes.
Well, I guess I'll go ahead with the question I was going to try to ask earlier about your influences. You've told us a lot of them already, but if you'd like to expand.
Yeah. I mean, tonight I mostly mentioned the writer influences or people I didn't. Obviously don't know myself. And I would say that the people who have influenced me, if I use that word, the most, or full stop influenced, were the people that I, and the people that I still am close to as artists, some of whom were hanging around in the mid, late 80s wondering if we were postmodernists. Sharon Hayes, another artist, Lana Lynn, people who were my colleagues and classmates. I often tell students this, that they really are in some way teaching each other, and I think that's what happened with me, where the thing that I think binds students together are having common questions and maybe not finding the same answers, but dealing with things together as colleagues and or, you know, young people. So in the most literal way, it's really those people. In a more sort of tertiary way, then it was probably the people who my friends and I were concerned with or looking at. My itinerary really had a lot to do with those debates around the role of, well, history versus literature or science versus literature, and then how that played out in nonfiction filmmaking. Is there such a thing as documentary filmmaking? What is a document as a film? And then what happens to those things when they are either brought or barge their way into the art context? So back from empiricism to the freedom or ambiguity of a fictional presentation. So, you know, I think just in the scheme of trends or things coming back or whatnot, the first generation of filmmakers to figure out how to put sound on film, how to mobilize the camera, how to record sync sound outside the studio, that whole generation, the crowd around Life magazine, Robert Drew and Penny Baker and Richard Leacock, not so much their intentions, but what happened was interesting to me. And then the French, or the continental version, and these two competing ideas about truth and representation through moving images. On the one hand, continental documentary hinging on the idea that the camera would actually be a catalyst or a tool of confrontation, that you would put the camera in front of someone and talk to them, and the truth would be forced out of them. It almost has a violent overtone, that a medium is really mediating. It's pulling something out of someone. And then in the States, the opposite model, the fly on the wall, the idea that if you could hide the camera completely and no one knows it's there, then you would get the truth. These like polar opposites that spring up simultaneously with mobile sync sound. And why was that? And then looking at those experiments and then kind of contrasting them. For some reason, you know, in the late 80s, that was available again or very interesting. I guess probably around these bigger conversations and around representation. So that was very influential on me.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
Going back to your some basic assumptions,
right,
and the dynamic of there being a conversation between artist, viewer, and subject. With that in mind, that seems like that's a basic assumption. But does that basic assumption then drive what and how you make, or is it something you just know is there?
It does for me, which is. And yeah, that's a good thing to point to, because that's why I started thinking about this, thinking about what I wanted to talk about coming here. And that has been very conscious. I wanted to do two things, I guess. Mention the obvious, these sort of conditions that I think everyone does deal with, whether they acknowledge it or not. And then to talk about, what kind of motivation that is for me, and the sorts of investigation that I find interesting. I tried to, the unasked question in the whole talk is, why do I choose these subjects, or why, not they're all connected in a certain way, but that's sort of arbitrary. But why do why get interested in the things that I do get interested in? And it is that social question, I think, of that dynamic. And then I suppose there's a big space where all these other things happen, or I do forget that I'm doing that. But at a certain point, it was really the decision for me to work with moving images and other kinds of projection in an exhibition space, because I immediately saw a different form of attention available and a different set of expectations. And I also saw how the very deliberate setup like this of the cinema architecture did not necessarily reproduce itself in a gallery, which is always why I've always been baffled by the black box aesthetic. Where like the cinema is rebuilt in the gallery, and at the same time, physically, just working with space, I've started to feel like a light source, a projection source, and the projection creates a social space. There's a kind of, even if you're the only one there and you're moving through that space, you think more about who has been there or who will be there than you do when you go to the cinema, unless it's very sticky and, you know. Then you think about who's been there, but... It's 8:20. Okay. There was one question in the back, I think. Was there someone? Yes?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This may be a gross mischaracterization of what I've been seeing, but at least my impression of the work that we've been seeing is that it's kind of deliberative, kind of cerebral, and very antithetical to say exuberant pop type art, say, to provide a contrast. And I wonder, apropos of what you were saying a little bit earlier, why this is the space that you choose to occupy, why that's what you seem to be more comfortable in. Or perhaps that's not true. Perhaps there's another side that we just haven't seen.
Right. Well, if I understand sort of the question about what kinds of work you see in which contexts, is that...
Put another way, what I think I've been seeing has been kind of cerebral, intellectual, kind of rigorous, carefully conceived, as opposed to, say, exuberant, romantic,
right,
pop outpouring of something that...
That's certainly true. It's, in many ways I've borrowed modes of address or ways of speaking or talking or looking or photographing from other traditions. Some of it is sort of throwing my voice, I would say. Other things are more sincere. I hope there's never a suggestion that this is what all art looks like.